that will be your special music. After that, we're hearing the message here, Feast of Tabernacles, for Mr. Gerald Corey.
And greetings to all of you around the world, and welcome to the Feast of Tabernacles 2008. I know that God is going to give us a wondrous Feast of Tabernacles. What a time we're living in today, and how we do need this Feast of Tabernacles. I thought I would mention to you the number of the sites that are receiving the satellite transmission. The listed here are the sites that will hear the transmission live by satellite or phone connection: Sandusky, Ohio; San Diego, California; Greenville, South Carolina; Vernon, British Columbia, Canada; Fredericktown, New Brunswick, Canada; Crown Point, Tobago; San Jose, Costa Rica; Veracruz, Mexico; Chile, Peru, and Colombia. Then we're sending the message to all of the beach sites around the world via the internet for playback tomorrow. That's Jerusalem, Belgium, India, Australia, Philippines, two places in the Philippines, Fiji, New Guinea, South Africa, Kenya, and Zimbabwe. So you can see this is quite an audience that God has given us. And certainly we need to reach out to all of God's people in every way we possibly can. At this time, we will hand out four booklets, or one small book and a free book that's to you here at Feast, as we mentioned before. John's Gospel, which I firmly believe is the most profound book that God has ever revealed to us. Lamentations, about reaching the point of no return. And that is certainly a timely book with a frightening warning for all of Israel and all this world. Then we will have the first volume of the Bible story and an updated version of Malachi's message. But you see what has been going on, brothers, and really our economy has reached a point of no return. This is my 48th Feast of Tabernacles, and I've never, ever experienced a feast like this. Not in all of those 48 years have I experienced such a Feast of Tabernacles. When you look back at September 15th, when that financial crisis began, it's like the U.S. Titanic hit the iceberg. And now they begin to scurry around trying to bail out the water or the problems. They had been warned and warned and warned, and the Titanic was warned. They received warnings. But look at all of the warnings that Israel has had for 70 years, as well as much of the rest of the world. Mr. Armstrong just sort of flashed before my eyes when I heard about what happened on the 15th. And you all remember that he said many times that may very likely lead to the uniting of the 10 nations in Europe. So this is going to be a time we really need to watch Europe, what's happening over there, because they are going to be uniting like never before as we struggle here and all of our experts try to come up with a solution. But there is no solution in man. Not for Israel and not even for the rest of the world. There simply is no solution. And you can see that even our presidential candidates. They think they have a solution, but they don't. They don't even have a clue how bad this is, I believe. And very few people do, if any, except God's people. But think about all the warning that we have given Israel. Now they scurry around trying to fill the holes, but all those years they've heard the message of God and refused to accept it. Still trying to work it out their own way and have to be shown by God these climate problems. They're only really making them worse. What a time we live in, brother. I want to thank all of you for your support of God's work. What a work we are doing. And look at around the world, what's happening to Australia and New Zealand and the United Kingdom. All their banks are imploding. Canada's somewhat better, but they're so tired of the U.S. that you know what that means. And Judah has all kinds of problems. But here we are still, as it were, keeping the Feast of Tabernacles on a sinking Titanic, if you will. And yet God says there are going to be lifeboats, and there are going to be people that are going to be protected, the people that are delivering His message and giving a warning to this dying world. And if ever we were able to see that, we ought to see it now. We ought to really be able to see it now and have a, well, let's say a more urgent perspective at this Feast of Tabernacles, and certainly a more sobering Feast of Tabernacles in that respect. But at the same time, brethren, even the one where we can rejoice even more, because it's getting so close to the second coming of Jesus Christ, which we've heard about oh so many years. And now we see it right on the edge, right on the precipice of being here facing us, and we'll be a part of it. But I hope, brethren, you'll really be watching the world news, because I'll tell you this, you just listen to people in the authority of this world, and they don't understand what they're dealing with, and many of them will even tell you that. But if we're not careful, you see, we can not understand ourselves what is really happening in this world, and how dangerously close to the tribulation we already are. You can just see it happening tomorrow because of what is happening in our financial markets and in our economy. So do keep watching, letting God show you exactly what is happening in this terrible, terrible world. I was planning on continuing in the book of Isaiah. And what I'm going to talk to you about today does definitely flow from Isaiah 22, especially where it is prophesied about the Jerusalem day. But I'm going to talk to you about something that's closely related to that, and that is the Ezekiel temple. I think, certainly, one of the main reasons, maybe the main reason we're over there digging in Jerusalem, is to give us an understanding and a focus on Ezekiel's temple. Now that may seem a little far-fetched, but what do you do if your society is about to fall apart and there's no government on the horizon that's going to be able to lead this world, I mean, not even one, then God wants us to begin to, in a practical way, show the world that there is a government and a nation about to rise and rule, and rule this earth the way it should be, and stop all of the suffering of this world. The suffering that you see, at least today, because of a defiance toward God. And I think you'll see the importance of that Ezekiel temple more as we go through this message today. I'd like to begin over in Ezekiel 40, verse 1, and ask you a few questions about why would God have us, commission us to do something like this? Why would God do that? Seems like a strange commission to God's people. Verse 4, well, let me just read verses 1 through 3. In the 20th year of our captivity, in the beginning of the year, the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year, after that the cry was, the crying was spitting in the self same day, that the hand of the eternal was upon me and brought me here. That what I'm going to do, I think I'm going to switch over to the Revised Standard Version, it's actually better. And we'll start in verse 3. When he brought me there, behold, there was a man whose appearance was like bronze, with a line of flies and a measure of reed in his hand. And he was standing in the gateway. And it's measured. This is all about 9 chapters about Ezekiel 7. Verse 4, and the man said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears, and set your mind upon all that I shall show you. For you were brought here in order that I might show it to you. Declare all that you see to the house of Israel. Declare all of it to the house of Israel. Well, how could Ezekiel do that? Was that for Ezekiel? Of course, we know that he was in captivity. And this is to the house of Israel, all things. The house of Israel. And he was a Jewish slave in captivity. Writing about the Ezekiel temple, he said, now you declare this, the management of that temple and all of the details of that temple, to the house of Israel. And of course, we know that only we can do that. And it is obviously for this end time. But he gets very specific about, well, measure this, measure that. I mean, this is an incredibly detailed specification of the temple of Ezekiel. And only we can deliver this message. And I'll tell you, brethren, we couldn't really deliver it without having been in on Jerusalem today. And I think you'll understand that as we go along. We simply couldn't do it. Because there's too much deception. And how can you even show this world where the Ezekiel temple will be built if you don't even know where Solomon's temple was built or Zerubbabel's temple was built? How can you even do that? But you can't. You're going to be seeing that I firmly believe that the world is just totally deceived about that. And I'm going to show you why today. But notice verse 46. Verse 46. And the chamber which faces north is for the priests who have charge of the altar. These are the sons of Zadok, who alone of the sons of Levi may come near to the eternal to minister to him. Now these are the sons of Zadok. These are the very elect that we talked about so much. And they're going to be in a chamber that is facing the north. And God says, well, now those sons of Zadok, you're going to have to even know where they're going to be stationed in that temple. It's in a chamber facing the north. That's pretty detailed information. Brethren, these are the people that come near to God. These are the people, very like the God of this Philadelphia Church of God, that's been loyal to God, those sons of Zadok, that just stick with David's song all the way through. And what a reward God has for them. Only they, in this context, are going to come near to God in this end time. And they're going to have a special job like that in the world tomorrow with many others who have gone before us. Notice verse 10. This is repeated several times in this 40. I think the 40 verse 10. I'll just back up, actually back it up a little bit. And there were three sides, one from each side of the east gate, and three were of the same size, and so on. Well, I don't need to read that, I don't think. And let's go to Ezekiel 43, verse 11. Just to give you some feel for what is written here in these 9 chapters. So let's read verse 10. And you, son of man, despised in the house of Israel the temple, its appearance and plans. You despise that, you son of man, into the house of Israel, the temple, and its appearance and plan. that they may be ashamed of their iniquities. Well, why would that make someone ashamed? Why would they become ashamed because of that? Well, there's a lot that goes with that, but we're going to be showing them where the world headquarters is that's going to straighten out all these economic problems and all the financial problems and have a stable world tomorrow, frankly, much more like the stable work of God today. Now you go out there, God says, and you show them how it's all going to work, and they're going to see it's vastly different than anything they're doing today. And in time, somewhere along the line, they're going to be ashamed of how they have been defiant toward the great God. And we're going to spell it out very, very clearly to them. And we've been doing it for 70 years, but the warning is going to get more specific and more detailed and more stark and more fearful to them until they can't take it anymore. That's what your Bible says. But notice verse 11. And they, if they were ashamed of all that they have done, for trade is simple, its arrangements, its exits, and its entrances in the whole form, and make known to them all its ordinances and all its laws. Oh, there's a big part of the plan too. Show them all its ordinances and all its laws, and write it down in their sight. Write it down in the trumpet. And then royal vision, write it down in their sight. Don't that have an impact on the Jews since they don't think about the temple? And frankly, brethren, have no concept of where it is. Or where it was, and where it will be. I'm totally convinced of that. And write it down in their sight so that they may observe and perform all its laws and all its ordinances. You see, it's going to, the warning verse, declare it, it's going to lead right into this government that is about to rule the world. That's exactly what God is talking about. And he said, now you write it in their sight. This is before the great tribulation. You write it down, but then they're going to say, well, after it's all happened and they're back in Babylon again, then it's going to have much more meaning to them. And they're going to be much more receptive to what God is trying to tell them, is going to tell them in time. Write it in their sight. And just show them the appearance and the plan, all of it, for Ezekiel's temple, where the Messiah is going to rule this world. You show them that. What a plan. What a plan. But can't we all see that all of the plans of man are crumbling before them and they are frightened? I even mentioned a little something about world conditions to a clerk yesterday. He said, you know what, it is scary. Sure, people are scared. It is scary, brethren. It is very scary. But you can see where we need the help of an artist, maybe an engineer, I don't know what all else, to make all this real, to draw that Ezekiel temple, and show the people how it's going to work. And we have a little type of it today on this earth. And a house for God is going up as God gives us plans to build another house. Which will make this one look, well, outdated. Somewhat. But think about that. God is a builder. And he has all these building plans for you and for me and for all the world, but they just will not get accepted. But what a builder God is. This is about the new world headquarters with Jesus Christ himself ruling from that temple. I would think God would want us to know a lot about it before he gets it and prepare it in the best way we can. Then in verse 19 of Ezekiel 40, let's just go to verse 4 of Ezekiel 44. Then he brought me by way of the north gate to the front of the temple, and I looked, and behold, the glory of the eternal filled the temple. temple of these tournaments. And I fell upon my face. And the Earl said unto me, Son of man, mark well, see with your eyes and hear with your ears all that I shall tell you concerning all the ordinances of the temple of the eternal, and all this laws, and mark well those who may be admitted to the temple, and all those who are to be excluded from the sanctuary. Well, we are making that pretty clear, aren't we, brethren? Those who are going to be in that temple and those that are not. The sons of Zadok will be the only ones in this church that will be in that part of the temple where they come near to God. And we have to make a distinction. God is the author of that. Verse 6, and saying to the rebellious house and to the house of Israel, thus says the eternal God, O house of Israel, let there be an end to all your abominations. In admitting foreigners, this is certainly talking to the Laodicean, in admitting foreigners, uncircumcised and hard and blessed, to be in my sanctuary, profaning it, when you offer to me my food, the fat, and the blood, you have broken my covenant in addition to all of your abominations. And you have not kept charge of my holy things, but you have set foreigners to keep my charge in my sanctuary. Well, that's the way it is for the Laodicean. Well, just open it up to everybody. That's all right. That's okay. That's really the way God wants us to do it, even though God's apostle taught them for oh so many years. That's not the way to do it. It can't be done that way. It cannot be done that way, because it isn't God's way. But isn't that amazing how quickly they rebel against God? Verse 15, but the Levitical priests, the sons of Zadok, you see they're different, who kept the charge of my sanctuary, when the people of Israel went astray from me, shall come near to me to minister to me, and they shall attend on me to offer me the fat and the blood, says the eternal God. So, who are those people? Who are those people that kept the ordinances of God? The kept the laws of God, just do it exactly the way God says. Who are they? And what does that mean to God? What does that mean to God? Well, we can see it very clearly here. They have a special, special role to play in the Ezekiel temple. I mean, right there in the temple, and they're going to go no more out. They're going to be there in Jerusalem forever. That's incredible and wonderful truth. Isn't that a wonderful truth, brethren, that we get to declare to this dying world? Isn't that magnificent? That we get to be a part of that? The sons of Zadok, they sure are special people in the eyes of God. He said, I'll have them come here to me, and that's it, in this last era. And they'll be doing the same thing in the world tomorrow. Ezekiel 46, verse 9. When the people of the land come before the eternal to the appointed feast, he who enters by the north gate to worship shall go out by the south gate. And he who enters in by the south gate shall go out by the north gate. And no one shall return by way of the gate by which he enters, but each will go out straight ahead. Well, we're going to have to know about which one, which direction is going, which is south, which gate is which. And so that would mean we'd have to know where it's been located in Jerusalem, wouldn't you think? Then we must know where it's located in Jerusalem. Or how could you possibly know something like that? And this is actually for our time, and it all begins before the world tomorrow. This is for today. We're going to have to draw them a picture and show them where the Temple Mount was. And it's not, I'm absolutely convinced, not where they say it is today at all. Close, but not there at all. And there are proofs from history, secular history, and Bible history that show us that. Certainly shows me But we need time. See, even God wants us to get in our minds, brother. We have to start planning. We have to start planning for this new temple, this new building program. Have everybody here for us. So when Christ gets here, we know what we're to do. And we have the mindset, and we're ready and excited about doing it. But you know something? It's going to be a little hard if we're not careful to really get this concept in our mind, because it is, after all, otherworldly. It's in another world. And we're going to have to get our minds on that world. And surely, when we see what is happening in this world, that ought to help motivate us. What happens if people's worst fears come to pass? What then? Well, this Eagle Temple is what then. That's what it's all about. Notice chapter 48, verse 11. He repeats this again, brother. Listen to this. This is about you. This shall be for the consecrated priests, the sons of Zadok, who kept my charge, who did not go astray when the people of Israel went astray, as the Levites did, or as the Laodiceans did. He keeps repeating over and over about the sons of Zadok. He wants us to get it. That's us. That is the very elect of God. He wants us to get our minds so onto this temple that we can declare it to the world, and we know precisely why we're doing so. We know why. And we're thrilled to be a part of it. And we're going to spell it out as starkly and as vividly and in living color to this dying world. And really, brother, you can't, it's just filled with hope. What is going to happen when all these governments fall apart, and they're about to fall apart? What is going to happen? Well, Ezekiel's temple has it all laid out very, very clearly. Verse 12. And it shall belong to them as a special portion from the holy portion of the land, the most holy place, adjoining the territory of the Levites. So where is that? Where is that? Well, we must know where Jerusalem is. And we must know where a lot of those places are. Verse 13. Well, let's just get down to verse 17. And the city shall have open land on the north 250 cubits. This is the city of Jerusalem. And on the south 250, and on the east 250, and on the west 250, and on it goes. Can you keep up with those measurements? Do you know where ancient Jerusalem was? Do you know where these dimensions are today? Well, we're going to have to do a lot of work and a lot of planning. We're going to have to know where ancient Jerusalem was, and where the temples of God were built, because one was built, Zerubbabel built the same place Solomon did, and the Ezekiel temple is going to be built the same place both of them were built. Same place. Where is that place? Well, we can't claim the Ezekiel temple if we don't know. And we could not know if we hadn't been involved in the Jerusalem city. I verily do believe you. It would have been all the hard any other way. Verse 35. The circumference of the distance around, the circumference of the city shall be 18,000 cubits, and the name of the city henceforth shall be the eternal there. Now that city is going to get bigger as time goes on. Certainly when God the Father gets here, it will be very different. But here he's talking about the measurements of Jerusalem in the world tomorrow. In the world tomorrow, we have to know about it today. Where is that temple now? The other place where the temple is going to be built. Where is it? Well, we're going to know, and we're going to know before Christ gets here, and we're going to even know the circumference of Jerusalem. But this thing, and use a little logic here. When we talked here in the past about the archaeological digs of the past, we have mentioned what was written in October 1971 with Tomorrow's World, and they were listing the discoveries of the dig, and they had the large Amun palace. That's an Arab palace. And they talked about the Wailing Wall, but is it really a part of Zerubbabel's temple? And the answer, brethren, is it is not. And I think it's clear, even from the Bible, that it is not. Then they talk about the rock tombs and some Roman artifacts, and mainly they were talking about these discoveries that they were making, but why weren't they finding something about David and about Nehemiah's wall, or about the first temple and the second temple? Perhaps it's because they were digging in the wrong place. And we're digging in the right place today. Now, even Mr. Armstrong didn't know, but Mr. Armstrong prepared the way for us. He prepared the way for us. It wasn't his place to do that. He was just to prepare, and I'm sure he was a little discouraged about what they found, but I'll tell you, we're not discouraged about what Dr. Mazar has found, and quite a lot of it with our help, thankfully. She's been gracious enough to allow us to do that. And I think with God's inspiration for us. But I'll tell you, what we have found out there is very, very significant. What we have found is going to help us warn the Jews in particular, but all of Israel, and even all of the world, from secular history and from the Bible itself. It is amazing how nobody really seems to look at the Bible. And the one unique thing about Dr. Mazar is she follows the Bible when she's digging. She follows the Bible history. And that makes her kind of odd to a lot of archaeologists. Because do you know of any others that do that? Well, I can't think of any. Did you know, brethren? Think about this. I mean, until David's palace was found, they had found virtually nothing about David from David's period. If you can fathom that, they found almost nothing, and they said, well, he was probably just kind of a little tribal chieftain, and that's about all there was to it. And all of a sudden, Dr. Mazar finds that his palace was with walls that are in some places 15 to 16 feet wide. It's a little bit more than a tribal chieftain, wouldn't you say? Or how about, they knew almost nothing about Nehemiah's wall. Nehemiah's wall or anything else about Jerusalem. And then all of a sudden, there is Nehemiah's wall, and that's about the second temple, built in the same place the first one was. And we're going to have to build Ezekiel's temple in the very same place, David's throne, in the same place, undoubtedly. And what a calling that is. I tell you, the more you get into this, it really is a practical arrangement. But you can see from the fruits of our digging. You can see from the fruits of it that we're digging the right place. And you can see from the fruits of the other ones that they're digging in the wrong place. Or at least I can see that, and I hope you can as well. I'll tell you, there's a practical reason why God is leading me into this understanding, and you'll be kind of amazed to where some of it came from, I think. Mr. Armstrong tried so hard to deliver the message to the cities of Judah, even prepared 13 programs to deliver to them, and he never did get to deliver them. But God says they will be delivered. That message will be delivered. And we're getting ready to deliver it in a way that the Jews are going to find it awfully disturbing if they don't yield and submit to God. It's going to agitate them quite a lot. God has given us a key. A key. Where is David Strong located? Where is it going to be in the world tomorrow? What is our goal, brethren? We sit here, and we don't want to fail to grasp this. We sit here, and we are the kings and the priests with the crowns and the thrones of the world tomorrow. That's who we are. Let the world scoff. Let them ridicule, let them do whatever they like, but that is the truth, and that is the provable truth. And Jesus Christ is alive, and He is the head of the church. He always has been. And yet we have to, the world, would ask more questions about, well, where is that church? They must be doing something pretty exciting. You'd think they'd reason that way, but Ezekiel 40, verse 4, brother, tells us that we have to declare this message. And there are 9 chapters there about this Ezekiel temple, and we're going to have to declare it. When you go, when Israel first came into the promised land, they had a tabernacle in Gilgal. That was their first one, and then they went on to what we call, I guess, a more permanent tabernacle, which is kind of an oxymoron, because tabernacle is temporary. We're here at the feast, it's very temporary. But at least it was established there in Shiloh with a certain amount of permanence, I guess you could say. And later came the temples of Solomon and Zerubbabel, and then, of course, there will be Ezekiel's temple. And it will have to end its reign in Jerusalem when the Father brings down New Jerusalem. And all this history just keeps pointing to the Father coming to this earth with New Jerusalem. But we have to go step by step by step to get there. We have to build God's house today to really kind of get a fix on what it's going to be like and what it means to build Ezekiel's temple and get ready for it. Who better to plan and devise Ezekiel's temple than the people who are building God's house today? Who better to do that? Well, there isn't anybody who can do it better. So let's look at Ezekiel's temple in these 2 satellite messages. I'll be getting into Isaiah a little more tomorrow. But this temple is going to be built in the same place, and I certainly think I can prove that too. But here we are, brethren. I mean, really, in a worldwide calamity. It's nice to think you're going to pull out of a worldwide calamity. But is Israel, are the birthright nations, and is the scepter nation, you know, are they going to pull out of it? You know what the prophecy said. But it's all a part of the plan, step by step by step, to Ezekiel's temple, and we'll never have to experience such horrors ever again. What a marvelous message this is to deliver to the world. Let me read to you something here. I'm going to have to read to you a little today. But we wrote this some time ago about these fellows. One of Jeremiah's accusers, Gedaliah, the son of Asher, had his name stamped on a small clay seal and recently discovered about 600 feet south of the Temple Mount, excavated under a tower at the northern end of the city of David, the original site of ancient Jerusalem. Original site of ancient Jerusalem. That's something you need to think about, including underneath the Nehemiah Tower with numerous remains and artifacts, including the Gedaliah. That date adds to the final years of the first temple period during the reign of Zedekiah, Judah's last king. 3 years ago, Mazar found another seal with the name of Jehoshaphat, the son of Shalmiah, mentioned twice in the book of Jeremiah. The Jehoshaphat bullet was found on the platform above the stepstone structure where Dr. Mazar has uncovered a small section of what used to be King David's Bible. Interesting that David had a palace, and here we find it right here at the end. Right there by where his throne was. We found the bullet, Jehoshaphat, inside the palace structure. The Lord told the trumpet God come yesterday. This time we found the bullet of Gedaliah outside the wall, just at the foot of the same spot we found Jehoshaphat. The two must have been connected somehow, she said. And they were. Both princes, the Bible relates, listen to this, brethren, the Jews need to understand their history, but they don't like to hear of history like this. But this is what they need to hear. Both princes, the Bible relates, unsuccessfully petitioned for Jeremiah's execution and were responsible for his imprisonment on two separate occasions. During Jeremiah's second internment, the Babylonian armies besieged and demolished Jerusalem, bound their Jewish captives in chains, including Zedekiah, and carted them off into Babylon captivity. Incredibly, the prophet Jeremiah managed to survive destruction and captivity. Mazar's two plate seals managed to survive as well, buried under 2,600 years worth of debris. It's not often, Mazar said, that such discoveries happen in which real figures of the past shake off the dust of history and so vividly revive the stories of the Bible. An unusual archaeologist. But remember when we mentioned so long how when Nebuchadnezzar came in there, Jeremiah was in prison, and he took the sons of Zedekiah and slew them right before Zedekiah, killed all the nobles of Judah. Nobody didn't want anybody to sit on David's throne or anybody to follow in that dynasty. And then he put out Zedekiah's eyes, took him to Babylon, put him in prison, and there he died 2 years later. And the whole world believed, brethren, that that was the end of David's throne. Well, I know about the prophecies and all that, the promises and all that, but it ended there. David's throne came to an end right there. Oh, no, it didn't. And all you need to do is to study some archaeology and you'll know better. Along with a few scriptures, it didn't end there. It just ended for Jerusalem for this age of man. Then, that's all. And we know that's all explained in this one throne book. And Jeremiah was released. It must have galled Satan after killing all those people in his mad mind trying to somehow stop this throne of David. It's going to be inside Ezekiel's temple and going to rule and put him into outer darkness. Oh, it must have galled him to see, well, it didn't end there, although he must have known something about the prophecies himself. But he's not exactly logical a lot of the time, or any of the time. That's the devil. But brethren, that's what happened, you see. That's what happened to the first temple that should concern Judah and all of Israel. That's what happened then. And that's why the throne of David was taken away from Jerusalem. And now Babylon, a modern Babylon, is back on the scene, and the Jews need to take note because it's going to be about 10,000 times worse, and the Israel needs to take worse because whether they like it or take note of this, or whether they like it or not, they're part of it. Babylon is back in this financial crisis. Has everything to do with a fast, meteoric rise of the ten nations. Wait and see. Watch it happen. Watch it happen. Now you see, we can take those two bullets and we can talk to people and say, do you know what this really means? And here was a prophet of God, really, truly one of the great prophets of all the Bible. And here were two princes that were responsible for getting imprisoned twice, and they kept lobbying for him to be killed. This great prophet of God, this all happened in Judah. This all happened in Israel. Because Judah is the part of Israel. This all happened there. And now we're finding David Strauss to go along with that. Hey, would you like to look at some of your past history and understand what really happened? Do you think maybe, just maybe, you might be religious today the way they were then and still are in rebellion against the great God? Well, that's the way it is. And that's what they have to hear. And that's what Israel has to hear from. David's palace symbolizes that whole key of David, the key of the house of David, that I'll probably talk more about maybe the last message I give on this subject. But Jeremiah had quite a vision. And I tell you, he took the throne away from Jerusalem. And the way he talks about it in Jeremiah 1, he talks about the his taking away from Jerusalem, and then he ties it directly in to the people that I think it says that indirectly in a way, the people that are going to have a hand in getting that home back to Jerusalem. They'll be honored by God to have a hand in that, honored by God to come near to God and deliver this wonderful message, and no telling what all God will have us do before he gets here. As long as we do our part and remain loyal sons of Zadok who do the ordinances and laws of God, we're going to show this world something they've never, ever seen before or ever will see again in this world, in this last hour. We're going to get ready to reestablish David's throne in Jerusalem, and this time it's going to be there forever. Forever. But what happened after Jeremiah left Jerusalem? Notice Jeremiah chapter 1. I'll just quickly read a little bit to you. Jeremiah 1 and verse 10. Jeremiah 1 verse 10 in the King James. Now you have to bring King James. Jeremiah 1 and verse 10. See, I have this day set you over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out and to pull down and destroy and to throw down and to build and to plant. So, God had a big plan for Jeremiah to root out, pull down, and destroy. And he did a lot of that before building and planting. And he did a lot of rooting out. And then he had to go and plant something. And that stone represents David's throne. I'll tell you, God does watch over that throne and fulfills that promise that he made to David and to all of us. And I just think it's interesting that Jeremiah talks about delivering that, fulfilling that commission and taking that throne to Ireland. And immediately after that, he gets directly into the very last hour of God's work, and I believe indirectly says to the Church of God that, well, we're going to have a hand in getting it back to Jerusalem because the Messiah is coming. And we have to do everything we can, not only to declare this to the world, but before we can declare it to the world, we need to get it deeply etched into our minds, so that we can be totally behind what God is doing and the plans he's making to establish the new world government. The Because that's going to happen whether we're around or not. It's going to happen. God is going to do it. Christ is going to do it. Nobody will ever be able to stop Him. Notice verse 11. Moreover, the word of the eternal came to me saying, Jeremiah, what do you see? I said, I see a rod of an almond tree. And I pointed out how this is our word. You can read it in the book of Jeremiah. Verse 13, the word of the eternal came to me the second time saying, well, what do you see? I said, I see a seething pot and the face thereof toward the north. Or is toward the north. A seething pot. Well, it's seething a lot more now after the financial collapse. It is really seething in Europe. Watch and see what happens over there, and make sure you understand Bible prophecy and world news, and you're going to be astounded by what is happening. You're going to be amazed at the prophecies that continue to be fulfilled. Verse 16, and I will utter my judgments against them, touching all their wickedness, the Laodiceans who have forsaken me and have burned incense into other gods and worshiped the works of their own hands. Well, hey, they just didn't really care too much about the United States and written prophecy and the book that God inspired to unlock one third of the Bible and tell you all about the birthright promises and the scepter promises. Well, they didn't see much need for that, I guess, and so they just rejected it. And forsook God. What law? What defiance? After all those years, just laid out there before them, and they forsook God. You think God will make them pay for that? He'll have to penalize them for that? Have you ever get them into his family? I think we know He will. I think we know He will. But notice, you see, after Jeremiah's commission, he gets right into our work. Every time something happens in God's church, and what happened in the worldwide church of God, one of the first books to go was the United States and Britain prophecy. All about these truly, truly marvelous prophecies of the Bible. And Satan would just destroy them so quickly, because Satan knows what this is all about, and he really knows he's putting the pressure on today, because he knows he doesn't have much time left until that throne is going to be on this earth. He knows that, and he's going to do everything he can to destroy it and to ridicule it and smear the people who do the work, but he will never stop it. If we do our part, never. Verse 17, when we got to this chapter, because after all, Jeremiah, at this point, I think it had most of his persecution. Certainly, the worst of it, I would think. Verse 17, you therefore gird up your loins and rise and speak unto them all that I command you. Be not dismayed at their faces, lest I confound you, or just break you in pieces before them. Verse 18, for behold, I have made this day a defense city, and an iron pillar, and brazen walls against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, against the princes thereof. This is against Judah, the princes of Judah, against the priests of Judah, and against the people of the land, just like in Jeremiah's time. Well, what do you know? They haven't changed anything. They're still the same old human nation. And all of the Jews and Israel, that's just the way they are. We have a message for Judah, don't we? Verse 19, they shall fight against you, but you shall not prevail against them. For I am with you, says the Eternal, to deliver you. You have to know, brethren, you have to know that God is with us. God is with you. And we will prevail because God is with us. As long as we have God, we can't do anything but prevail. That's for sure. Why is it that Mr. Armstrong wasn't really given this revelation about the covenant meet with a man and proclaim this message throughout? I think because we needed encouragement from God and we needed help from God to realize we're very much a part of this promise made to David And that we have a great responsibility to get this message out to the world and make sure that the laity don't destroy it. Or anybody else. And God said, you stay with that message and you will prevail. All the way to the end. You will prevail. A promise of God. And we had it revealed to us that God not only made that promise about David's throne, but through the message that would be delivered by that very elect, supported by the very elect people through a man, frankly. So, just look though at verse 15. I'll just, you can look at those again where it talks about the cities of Judah. Verse 18, the kings and the princes and the priests and the people of Judah. Cry aloud. Cry out to the cities of Judah. Cry out. Tell them about the two fathers. Tell them about the two fathers where these princes imprisoned Jeremiah twice and lobbied so hard to get him killed. And would have done it had it not been for God, who said Jeremiah would prevail in the midst of all of that. And we can use those bullets to enrich our warning, our message to Judah and the entire world, and tell them right from the ground that they walk on. That God lives, and the same circumstances prevail today as they did then as far as Judah and Israel are concerned. But still, the message is there, just like it was at the time of Jeremiah. God gets the message to them. And the two balls really do help us get that message across. Think about this, what revolves around those balls. And what meaningful that Bible history and prophecies are tied to those artifacts. Amazing finds in that Jerusalem day. Just hard to overemphasize. Rule that, pull that. What are we going to do, brethren? What is God going to have us do before this is all over? Notice what it says about Nehemiah's wall. He wrote this in trumpet. I'll just read a little bit to you. The discovery comes 2 years after the Darwin built a small section of King David's royal palace. Dr. Darwin was introduced yesterday as the first speaker at the conference, walking up to the podium without the benefit of any notes. He delivered an impassioned, persuasive 30-minute presentation straight from the heart. She spoke about the fantastic discoveries made at the palace during the last 2 years. The 5-meter wide wall, the room, the collections of metal and history, the pottery, the bowl, and so on. Well, for the rest of the morning, Dr. Zora's colleagues spoke one to another, each of them picking apart her findings. What a shocker. What a shocker. Oh, we have to pick this apart. All these scholarly people, they can pick anything apart. And they can also go into Babylonian captivity if they don't watch their step. Because it sure is coming fast. But some even rejected their conclusions. I mean, these are scholars. These are the elite of the world of archaeology. But the entire morning session of perhaps the most important archaeological conference of the year in Israel was devoted to a lot of Zara's work, not her theories, her work. And that's the way she writes it. As she has said before, in the end, the stones will speak for themselves. Oh, how true it is! How true it is! The stones are going to speak for themselves! It's out there. The message is there. Just look in the book. It's there for everybody to see. Last summer, Mazar's grandfather was the late Professor Benjamin Mazar began an emergency dig near the top of Jerusalem's famous stepstone structure in order to repair a collapsing tower. But what started as a reconstruction project quickly turned into a fascinating collection of new discoveries. Communist towers become rich assemblies of pottery and other finds. Mazar concluded that the tower must have been built by Nehemiah after the Jews returned from Babylonian captivity to rebuild the temple and repair the walls around Jerusalem. Nehemiah's wall. I'll tell you, that's quite a find. It tells you, hey, you're digging in the right place. You see? But not even after that 70 years, let them come back and build the temple of Zerubbabel. And they finally learned the lesson, right? Well, all they did, there's 70 AD. When you read about this, read Josephus and the terrible, terrible stories of human cannibalism, just mind-defying truths as far as being able to accept them, readily accept them anyhow, because it really didn't happen. See, brothers, what is it going to take? What does it take? They had the great Jeremiah there, and well, they couldn't listen to that man. Put him in prison, shut up the message. Well, then, okay, the next time God sends a son, his own son. His own son. And they killed him. We all killed him. There's room for repentance in all. There's room for a lot of repentance. And oh, how we in this world hate repentance. How we hate repentance and how we ought to love it. I mean, even today, Jesus Christ is considered anathema to a lot of Jews. Rejected the New Testament because, well, that's Christ. Well, they really did kill him. They really did butcher him. They really did just beat him to a pulp. They really did do that. Of course, we all did that, didn't we? We all did that to the great Christ who wants to give us everything. We'll see more of that tomorrow. Human nature is hard. Let's not let our human nature prevail. We're here at the Feast of Tabernacles to learn to conquer our human nature and have the very mind of Jesus Christ and to be at one with this Bible and with Christ and with God the Father. At one, atonement. That's what it's all about. God is going to bring the whole world to be at one with Him. And it's very, very close. Sure, we can all see that from what's happening in the world. Notice Nehemiah 8. Nehemiah 8. And we'll take a look at what happened by Nehemiah's wall. Notice what they were doing, you see? And all the people gathered themselves together as one man in the street before the water gate, and they spoke to him as Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the eternal Lord commanded to Israel. And Ezra the priest brought the law to the congregation, both of men and women, and all they could hear from understanding upon the first day of the seventh month. Feast of Tabernacles time, that's what it's all about. Verse 3, he read therein before the street, and that was before the water gate from the morning until midday. That's the water gate I'll talk about quite a bit tomorrow. And he's standing right there by the water gate, right there in a key location that also proves perhaps more than anything else where the Ezekiel temple will be and where the temple will be and the Holy of Holies and all of it. And it's in your Bible. It's also proven by secular history in a powerful way. But anyhow, he was standing there close to Nehemiah's wall, right by it, and right by this water gate before the men and the women and those that could understand, and the ears of all the people who were attentive to the book of the law. They were just so attentive. Isn't it wonderful? These people just loved it, right? Verse 5, and Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he was above all the people like I'm standing above you today. And when he opened it, all the people stood up. They stood up. They were so respectful of this word. And as the blessing eternal, the great God, and all the people answered, amen, amen, when lifting up their hands, and they bowed their heads and worshiped the eternal with their faces toward the ground. Then verse 9, and Nehemiah, which is Tershava, and Ezra, the priest, the scribe, and the Levite, saw the people, said to all the people, this day is holy to the eternal, your God. And mourn not, nor weep, nor weep and mourn, for all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. Why did they weep, brethren, when they heard the words of the law? Well, they had just returned from captivity in Babylon. And oh, how thankful they were to be back hearing God's law and building Jerusalem and building the temple. And they were so happy that they couldn't stop crying. They couldn't stop weeping. But it didn't happen until after they were gone into captivity. That's the sad part of this whole history. That's what happened when they heard the words of the law. Verse 10, when he said unto them, go your way, eat the fat and drink the sweet. That's what we need to be doing in this feast of tabernacles, brethren. Eat the fat and drink the sweet. And send portions unto them for whom nothing is prepared. If you know somebody that doesn't have much and you can help them and give like God does. Give to your brethren and serve like God serves. For the day is holy to our eternal, neither be you sorry, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. The joy of the Lord is our strength. So the Levites, if we don't have joy, what is wrong? What's wrong, brethren, if we don't have this joy? So the Levites still, all the people say, hold your peace, for the day is holy, neither be you greasy. And all the people went their way to eat and drink and send portions and make great murder because they had understood the words that were declared unto them. Just to be there and understand these words. To be here and understand how wonderful that is to hear the law of love. And the joy of God is our strength. It fills us with joy. It fills us with excitement. It fills us with everything good. How blessed we are to be here. And remember, the joy of the Lord is mentioned in the context of the law. That's hard to teach that to human nature, isn't it? Well, it's impossible to human nature, but the people with the human nature and the spirit is all that. In many ways. See, today we're digging up that wall, picking up the wall where Ezra stood, right there where we did it, so many years ago, teaching the law. And they were building another temple, and they felt so honored. So on to be a part of them, and they just cried. And they were weeping. And they couldn't even rejoice properly until the ministers went and talked to them and said, oh, look, hey, this is the Feast of Tabernacles. This the joy of the Lord is your strength. Don't let the grieving overwhelm you. This is the time to rejoice, even if you're on a sinking Titanic. Rejoice. We're commanded to. We're commanded to rejoice by God. What a lesson men have to learn. Look at the Laodiceans. Look at the Laodiceans. Pathetic that all of that truth that God's apostle gave them, all of that wonderful truth, a very house built for God. They had it all. And they forsook God. They turned away. Is human nature hard? We better look at ourselves closely because we're here, brethren, to learn to fear God and not let something like that happen. And I think the fact that we're building God's house may be the greatest physical sign that we do fear God, that we are sons of Zadok. be one of the great physical signs that we are doing it right, brethren. We have to continue, and we have to bear down, and we have to realize what we're dealing with. We all have human nature. We all stumble. And how blessed we are to be here. I mean, this is just something that can just overwhelm you with joy when you truly understand what God is giving us. What God is giving you, the sons of God. We're builders for God. But I still marvel that if after all these years they had found virtually nothing about the burial of David or of Nehemiah. They're just digging all over the place. They've done holes all over the earth. But they don't know where it is. First, before you start digging, you need to know where it is. And we're going to show them where they should have been digging and where we're going to dig, and we're going to help Jesus Christ establish the Ezekiel temple before the whole world. And before we do that, we're going to give them a picture, we're going to give them a drawing, we're going to give them something artistic that they can see and get the picture in their heads that this is the headquarters of the future government of God that is almost ready to burst on the world scene, and nothing or nobody can possibly stop it. Nobody. That's how important this is. The Messiah is coming. He's almost here. And he says, brethren, you declare this. You declare it. That's a commandment from God. You declare this to the world. You tell them where the Temple of the Mount really is. You tell them what the Wailing Wall is not. And that can be true. I believe rather easily. But here we are, brethren. What? Who are we? Who are these sons of Zadok? They're kings and priests. God is really serious about this. We're kings and priests. And we're going to teach the kingly part and the priestly part of the message. We're going to give them all of it. We're going to give them everything. And the kind of rule that will direct everything. Kings and priests. That's who you are. Kings and priests and embryo. Just waiting to be born in the very family of God. And sit and rule right there in Ezekiel's temple with Jesus Christ. What a future. What a future. What an unbelievable opportunity we have where we'll be there in Jerusalem and the headquarters temple and go no more on. What an honor. And we're right on the edge of that coming to reality. Right on the edge. And we need to get this message desperately and understand it as deeply as we possibly can. Because the alternative to getting this message is facing battle. And if you think God is kidding, study the two bubbles. Study David's palace. Study about Nehemiah's wall. And you know that God is serious. Because man has to learn. He has to learn. He cannot solve his problems. These men who have all the scholarly ability don't know how to solve the problems. Only God knows that. Only God knows that. Why can't we be more childlike? Why can't we revive the spirit of the humble, as Isaiah tells us to do? Well, I'll tell you, that archaeological dig has really empowered our message. But the findings that are there, the doctrines are found, and we've been honored to help her in some ways, at times. And we know that God certainly has been involved in this. Oh, brethren, that saving thought is there. The Jews and Israel, all they have is a history of rebellion. A history of rebellion. If they even understood, just an, had an inkling of what the Bible teaches, they'd at least be examining themselves and say, well, maybe we're not doing this God's way. If they have any belief in God at all, well, maybe we might be making the mistake that the Jews did in Jeremiah's time, or in the Babylonian time, or in the Assyrian time when they conquered Israel. Maybe we have that attitude. Maybe we don't fear God. But here is a Feast of Tabernacles to teach them how to solve the problem. So you come here to the feast to learn to fear God. Fear God. And everything begins to fall into place. Everything. Isn't that just truly miraculous? To be a part of such a beautiful plan. When Isaiah 40 talks about, behold your God, he's really talking about, look at those two laws. Look at David's palace. Look at Zerubbabel's palace, the temple, and the Nehemiah's wall, and all of that. Behold your God. It's all preparation for God. It's all leading up to the second coming of Jesus Christ, which is where God wants us to get our minds. The second coming of our husband. We have that exalted honor to be the bride of Christ. And don't get apologetic when you talk about being kings and priests, because that's quite a high level calling and responsibility that it's just, you just have to keep working and working and working to fully understand how honored we are. How honored we are, brethren. And don't let Satan lead you away from who you are, from understanding this, who you are. We must know that. Well, you can look at Ezekiel 21, verse 25 through 27, where it talks about, talks about the three older turns until he comes, who Christ is, or Jesus Christ. Let's just quickly read Isaiah 16. And I've read this to you before, but as a reminder, it would be good to think about this again, because of what God may use us to do. And it certainly does indicate we'll be used in an interesting way. Isaiah 16, verse 1, sent you the land, the ruler of the land, upon Selah, in the area of Petra. Verse 2, for it shall be that as a wandering bird cast out of the nest, where the people are cast out. Who are these? Who are these people? Well, these are the sons of Zadok. Verse 3, take counsel, execute judgment, make your shadow of the night, and so on. Hide my outcast, hide the outcast. It says, verse 4, let my outcast dwell with Moab. But notice verse 5, in mercy shall the throne be established. In mercy shall the throne be established. And he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. Well, that is, after all, certainly representing the very throne of David. And it looks like a little group of people are going to have a hand in establishing that. Or the Hebrew for established means prepared. We are getting ready for the return of Jesus Christ. And there's no telling what we might take part in or be a part of before Christ gets here. We just don't know. But scriptures like that really make it look like we're going to have a pretty heavy hand in quite a lot of this. Well, I want to get into some material to you, and I'll try to move along as quickly as I can. May have to read more of it tomorrow. But I want to mention something to you about a book. Ernest Martin died 3 or 4 years ago, on January 16th. I forget which year it is, frankly. But I thought at the time, well, that's interesting. Here's a man that worked for Mr. Armstrong so long and did a lot of significant things for him, like working 10 years in that Jerusalem day. And he died on January 16th. I thought, well, maybe there's a COVID message there. And I think that it certainly made it mean a bleak future. But I believe there was more to it than that. that maybe he had something to teach us that would add to the Elijah message. Because after all, he was directed by Elijah. And he did write a lot, and he wrote a lot about the Jerusalem dead. So, if he was there 10 years, and a very scholarly person, maybe God used him in spite of himself. But after all, it's just Armstrong who was in charge of all that. But he wrote about ancient Jerusalem and the ancient temple, and the title of the book, it's a little confusing in places, but it has some fantastic material in it. And we'll be quoting a lot of it to you as we write this up and make it a lot clearer to you. It could be confusing. But anyhow, he titled the book The Temple that Jerusalem Forgot. And here is what the back cover says. Dr. Ernest Martin has taught Israel for 12 years at a college in England. He's been the chairman of the Department of Theology and another in California. Leaving out a lot of the details, as you can see. Has supervised over 450 college students at the most significant archaeological excavation ever conducted in Jerusalem for 2 months each year for a period of 5 years. And his archaeological, it actually extended into 10, but his archaeological educational program was featured in the educational section of Time magazine for September 3, 1973. Now, this is his book. He printed it, and he says it was his archaeological educational program. No, it wasn't. Wasn't his, it was God, and God's apostle was the one in charge. But nevertheless, that's what he said. I have had the pleasure, he said, and this is the introduction, I've had the pleasure and the good fortune of being brought into the company of many of the top historians and archaeologists of Jerusalem over the period of my professional career as a historian and a theologian. My first visit to Jerusalem in 1961. I later met Professor Bazar San Ori, who was the first to recommend to me the temples of Solomon and Jeroboam were located on the Ophel Mount, just in the north of the original Mount Zion on the southeast ridge. So that would be, Lot's husband, and he said his father was leaning in that direction at the time of death. That is, the Temple Mount really wasn't where they think it is. Now, Dr. Elazar, the one we're working with, the lady we're working with, doesn't agree with this. But nevertheless, this is some of the history of that. But again, you see, Dr. Benjamin Bazar seemed to be, would have to be leaning a little bit that way because he wasn't finding anything significant. And he'd been digging right up there by the Temple Mount. Or at least a lot of it was right there against the Temple Mount. And he wasn't finding anything like David's palace or Nehemiah's wall or the boa that I talked to you about. And it had to be somewhat depressing to me. So here's what Dr. Martin said. My first I don't think I need to read it any more than to you necessarily, but he talked about his bachelor's college. And what he did there, and what he, in all of the years he was over there, and what Time magazine said, he featured my academic program, and never ever mentioned God's apostle once, not even once. And it wasn't his academic program. That's just the height of vanity and defiance, or terrible ignorance. That God's apostle was used to direct that program, and if you're going to give any man the credit, we'll give him the credit, although he always knew and gave God the credit. But you see, this is human nature. We just naturally want to take credit for everything, and so he just sort of blotted the Armstrong out of the picture, and probably is blotting himself out of the picture. And how men can become so vain and think they know everything and they know nothing. And all they do is turn and forsake God, trying to build a little bit of vainglory in this evil world. And God is trying to tell us He wants to give us everything. To get some vision and get rid of all of the scholarly vanity and think and act like God. Christ wasn't that way when He was on this earth. But look, brethren, look at all of them. Revelation that has just flowed into the church as well as into the church of the destruction. Look at them. If you help get that message to the world, God says you're going to shine like stars. And you'd rather have a little scholarly work on this earth? You're going to shine like stars! And the brightness of the firmament! And He wanted a little work of His own. How absolutely nauseous that ought to make us. Notice in Psalm 135 and verse 5, 137 verse 5, sorry. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her hand. Well, you feel that way about Jerusalem? One translation would say, I guess it's literally verse 6. Though the eternal be high, yet have he respect unto lowly. Oh, sorry. Verse 6 is the wrong chapter. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. Now, if you prefer Jerusalem above your chief joy, think about this, brother. If you really prefer Jerusalem above your chief joy like David did, well, David knew that Jerusalem was going to be, everything in the world tomorrow was going to around Jerusalem. Everything. And then after the millennium and the last great day, everything in the universe is going to revolve around Jerusalem, which of course it was in the land as well. But with God the Father being in Jerusalem. How about that? That is your chief joy. Above your chief joy. Now let me read you from Dr. Lawrence's book. And just bear with me, I'll have to read you some of this. But here's what he wrote. Even the worshippers of the Wailing Wall are directing their present devotions and veneration to a Roman edifice that their ancestors in Herod's time held in utter contempt. And I believe he's right. You can see that as we go along. And we'll have to write up quite a lot of it. But here's what he wrote. Josephus, a historian priest, who wrote two accounts in the Greek language within a period of 20 years concerning matters dealing with the Roman-Jewish war. He recorded with great detail events involving the destruction of the temple and the city. He also gave the appraisal by Titus, the Roman general, and later emperor, who saw the final ruin of Jerusalem. Besides this, Josephus recorded the eyewitness account of Eleazar, the leader of the last remnant of the Jewish resistance at Masada, where 960 Jewish people died by their own hands in 73 AD. Eyewitness accounts, Josephus, Titus, and Eleazar. And they have a very different view of where the temple was. But the scholars, even though they looked at Josephus more than any other historian in that time period, they said he just got into wild exaggerations here. Did he? I'll tell you, I go to Josephus and I think like it's the most reliable history of that period that I've ever read in my life. Something's wrong here. And he said, Caesar gave orders, this is from Josephus, Caesar gave orders that they should now demolish the entire city and temple. Just everything. Okay. And it was so thoroughly laid even with the ground, Josephus said, by those that dug it up to the foundation, that there was left nothing to make those that came there believe that Jerusalem had ever even been inhabited. Now this is Jewish Jerusalem. Actually, that temple mount is just outside of the area of ancient Jerusalem. It's at what's called the Temple Mount or the Wailing Wall today. Whereas the war had laid all signs of beauty quite waste, nor if anyone had known the place before it come on a sudden, through it now, again, Josephus, would he have known it again? But though he, a foreigner, were at the city itself, yet would he have inquired for his servant. Where's Jerusalem? Nothing there at all. Now, again, brethren, there's a lot more here with the eyewitnesses. I mean, but what is even a greater proof is the Bible itself. Notice Matthew 24, verse 1. I want to show you something here that I have not understood in the past as I should. And I thought this was all a part of that end time prophecy, but notice how God speaks about this in Matthew 24, verse 1. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. The buildings of the temple. Now, here's what Dr. Martin said. The usual explanation to justify the credibility of the prophecies is to say Jesus should only have been speaking about the stones of the inner temple and its building, not the outer temple and its wall that surrounded it. He has good proof here. Notice this. The Greek word Jesus used in his prophetic context, and I'm going pretty fast, but we'll back this up later. I have to hurry to get through a little bit. The Greek word Jesus used in his prophetic context to describe the temple and its building was Hieron, H-E-I-R-O-N. That means the entire temple, including its exterior buildings and walls, all of them, building, the temple and the other buildings around as a part of the temple. This means the entire temple, including its exterior buildings and walls. Notice what Benson Word Study says about the meaning of Hieron. Quote, the word temple, Hieron, literally sacred place, signifies the whole compass of the sacred enclosure, with its porticos, courts, and other supporting buildings, and should be carefully distinguished from, there's another page that concludes that, I don't need to read all that anyhow. But in Mark 13, verse 1, let's read that and we'll come back to Matthew 24. And as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. Buildings, plural. And he says in verse 2, and Jesus answered and said to him, see these great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now, let's go back to Matthew 24. I'll go to verse 2. Well, let's read verse 1 again. Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, see you not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. He's talking about the temple and all of the temple buildings. Every one of them. And frankly, he's talking about Jerusalem too. You'll see as we go through here. But here's the thing. I always thought, well, that's just the end time prophecy, and the Wailing Wall would just be torn to blitherings and it's the end time. But notice, this verses 1 and 2 is really not talking about the end time, but about the 70 AD crisis. Because he's looking at the temples and talking about them then. And of course, they're not even there today. But notice, then he switches in verse 3 to the end time. And this is a different location. They're now out on the Mount of Olives, which is away from the temple some distance. But then he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came into him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of your coming into the end of the world? So, now, he's in a different place and he's asking a couple of questions. Tell us what these things will be, and what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the world. Now, I think he primarily just answered the last question there, because they wanted to know about the end of the world, brethren. They wanted to know about the end of the world. Christ, well, he didn't tell them at that time that he wasn't going to return right away. And they thought he was going to be coming back much sooner than what he was. But those men, brethren, every one of them, as far as I can tell, except John, were martyred before 70 AD. He knew they would all die because they were preaching God's message. They would have to die. And he said, now, here's what I want you to concentrate on. I want you to concentrate on the second coming. My second coming, I want you to concentrate on the end of all this so that you can be willing to, well, if you have to be martyred, be martyred. Get your mind on the second coming. That's not always easy to do, is it? That's the main concern he has for you, brethren. Get your mind on the second coming. Luke 19 says the same thing. I don't need to read that to you. And here is another account from Josephus in Jerusalem. He says, this is Dr. Martin, what is remarkable is the fact that the eyewitness accounts given by Josephus and Titus agree precisely with what Jesus prophesied. No, these two men observed, quote, if Jerusalem with its walls was so thoroughly laid even with the ground by those that dug it up to the foundation, they dug it up to the foundation. This is talking about Jerusalem. That there was left nothing to make peace that came there, believe, in Jerusalem that had ever been inhabited. Well, and they just saw a desert. That's basically what it's about. And here's another place where Josephus wrote, so the flames destroyed the Holy of Holies, and one of the Jewish leaders and the rebels and their followers who were still in the city of Jerusalem saw that the Holy of Holies had been burned. They burned the rest of the temple together with every mansion in Jerusalem so that the Romans should not rule over them. And they also burned down the rest of the temple buildings. Saying, now that the Holy of Holies has been burned, why go on living? Why leave house or building? Now, what is that waiting for? Well, Dr. Martin really proved that very well. But you see, brother, there is going to be a temple built, a temple that God is going to build, and we have to show them where it's going to be. 6 months after the war, the 10th Legion dug up the ruins of the houses, buildings and walls, looking for plunder. They also had the whole area turned upside down looking for gold and other precious metals that became molten when the fires were raging. The temple was one of their chief sources for riches. Josephus tells us the temple was effectively the treasury for most of the Jewish people. Do you think the Romans would have dug down the torn walls down? They actually used the Jewish slaves to do it for them. There was gold throughout that place. And I thought this was mentioned back here. The temple was especially vulnerable because the soldiers knew that that was the central treasury of the nation. Such great quantities of gold were discovered in the ruins of Jerusalem, and the sweep of riches that Josephus said, the price of that metal in the Eastern Empire plummeted to half its former value. Well, that's rather amazing. I mean, would you tear down all those walls if you knew there was gold in there? Now, just a little bit of it, even now. Well, you tear the wall down. But then, that's what Christ was talking about in those first two verses. I mean, it's just going to be swept clean. It was prophesied by Christ himself. And I tell you, I think the proof is just overwhelmingly abundant. Josephus states that Titus saw, yet there was no small quantity of riches that had been in that city, still found among the ruins, a great deal of which the Romans dug up. But the greatest part was discovered by those who were captives. Jewish captives were forced by the Romans, true, to dig up the stones and so on. I'll tell you this, brother, that's a lot of bad news. When you look at this world, there's a lot of bad news. There's just been bad news everywhere you look. And the Jews were terribly discouraged when that all happened in 70 AD. But why didn't they learn from Jeremiah? Why didn't they learn? the way human beings tend to think. Elie Wiesel, here he said this, where is this city that was killed on in leading up in Sodomville? Where is the city that was believed to have God himself and have him therein? What a disappointment. They thought God was there. They even thought God was there. Well, Jesus Christ was. He was God in the flesh. He was there, but he left. And he said, it's now demolished to the very foundations. He's talking about the city. And has nothing left but that monument of its reserve, I mean the camp of those of the Romans that has destroyed it, which camp still dwells in one of the waiting wall is a Roman edifice. I think that can be proved. And that's a sad truth. That's the way it is. He said, I cannot but wish that we had all died before we had seen that holy city demolished by the hands of our enemies, or the foundations of our holy temple dug up after so profane a man. No, he said, the foundations of our holy temple dug up. Even the foundations were dug up. Apparently looking for gold there as well. And maybe they had other goals too, I don't know. Can you imagine the Romans leaving into that temple after the Jewish revolt? What else? I don't think that we should expect that. Dr. Martin writes, without doubt, the Hormet or El Sharif with its gigantic walls survived in the war of 70 AD, and those ramparts continue to exist to this day. But how could Josephus have failed to account for the business? How could Josephus have failed to account for the retention of such spacious and magnificent site that was clearly in existence in pre-war Jerusalem? Because it was outside the city of Jerusalem. And the Jewish. And there's a difference. Well, again, brother, we need more writers to understand this, but how can they so easily reject a historian like Josephus? And he was also a priest. He was also a priest. Well, anyhow, it's just a little skip here and bring that up tomorrow. But here we have already found, along with, of course, the assisting Dr. Bazar, we found David's palace. And just so much of there with Nehemiah's wall and those two balls. And God wants us to use that, brethren, to make that history come alive. And get prepared. Get our minds on the Ezekiel temple, because Christ is coming. Christ is coming to this earth. He said, now, I want you to declare it to the world. I want you to spell it out and show them that this is serious business. Show them where we're going to rule from, how we're going to rule, how we're going to operate in this earth, and we're going to rule with a rod of iron and bring this earth peace and joy and happiness forever. And they're going to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, and they're going to keep the last great day, and we're going to be right out there teaching them as God's kings and priests. And we're going to teach them how to keep the feast. And we're going to teach them how to rejoice. And forget the grieving, forget the tribulation, all that horror, because it's time to rejoice. And God has called us, brethren, He's called us here to be a part of this and have the wonderful honor to declare Ezekiel's temple to the world. And what good news that is, and what a wonderful opportunity God has given all of us. So look forward to talking to you again tomorrow. Bye.